May God bless us while we study together. Two words, two very simple, single-syllable words present themselves to us tonight for some rich consideration. These two words are the two words lost and found. They are monosyllables. They are very simple, and yet they're so profound. I suppose that there are no other two words in the entire human language that draw such an emotional response out of the human heart as do these two words, lost and found. The word lost can bring together outright strangers who will join hands and walk across a field looking for a missing child. And it matters not that they don't know each other. The lostness of the child brings them together in a common objective. And then when the news is announced over the radio that the child has been found safe and sound, people who don't even know the child sense a warmth and a fullness of their heart expressing their appreciation and thanksgiving for someone's child that's been lost. Even a lost ball is important. Did any of you, as you played as children, playing ball in a nearby lot, someone is eventually bound to knock the thing over into a grass, high, tall grass area, or foul it off back into some unused portion of the field. And I remember it as well as if it were yesterday, the way we used to play. And when that happens, everybody just simply says, "Oh no." You lay your bat down, you put the gloves down, and everybody gets an old stick or whatever, and they go looking through the tall grass looking for the ball that was lost. And some clown, after you've been looking for it for a while, said, "Here it isn't." And everybody's already about 3 feet off the ground when this nut makes this statement, and then everybody gangs him, you know, because it's too serious a business to make fun of. And then the person that really finds the ball, why, he's the hero for the rest of the day. Well, that's the way it is with these two words, lost and found. I believe that these two words encompass the entire message of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. That's it, isn't it? I believe that the entire scheme of redemption is wrapped up in these two simple words, lost and found. I'm confident that the gospel of Jesus Christ, the good news for man, that good news is wrapped up in these two words, lost and found. And that tells the entirety of it. In the 15th chapter of the book of Luke, Jesus actually told three parables that use the word lost and found. He tells the parable of the lost sheep, a dumb animal, worthless maybe in some respects, and yet to the owner, very useful and very worthy and very worthwhile. So much so that he leaves 99 sheep in the fold and goes and looks for that one that's lost. And when he finds it, he puts it on his shoulders and comes back, and there's such rejoicing that he calls his neighbors and says, "I've found my sheep. Come and make merry with me." He tells next the parable of the lost coin. An inanimate object has no sense. It has some worth, intrinsic worth. And yet, to the owner, it's very valuable. So valuable that the woman who lost it stops whatever else she's doing, turns her house upside down, sweeps until finally she locates that lost coin. And then, in joy, she sends to her neighbors and says, "You know the coin that I lost? I've found it. Come on and let's make a feast. Let's rejoice together." And these two parables do indeed tell the meaning of lost and found to a degree. And you can identify with one of these two. You've probably lost a puppy dog or a cat, or you've probably lost a dollar bill or a 50-cent piece or something that you felt a great loss over. And then the joy of finding it again, you can identify with these two parables. But I'm so glad he didn't stop with these first two, because the real meaning of lost and found remains unexplored and unexplained and unexpressed until we come to this third parable, the parable of the lost boy, or the parable of the lost girl. There's been a lot said about this parable. It has been said that It's the most beautiful story in all human language. I believe that. It certainly is the most representative of you and me as we wander away from God, stumble around in life in sin until we come back home to God. It represents you and me. I find myself in this parable. I find that it is, as Augustine said, "Thou hast made us for thyself, O God, and there is no rest for the soul until it rests in thee." That's what this parable is about. The parable actually is a what you might call a current historical drama. It's current in the sense that it is up to date, it's modern, it's 20th century. Or it's garbed in a garb 2,000 years old, but the message is 20th century. It's next morning's newspaper. It's historical in the sense that it can be documented in the life of every boy and every girl, every man and every woman that's ever lived on the face of the earth. That's how historical it is, with one exception, that is the one telling this story, the Lord. It's a drama in the sense that the deepest and most meaningful emotions of both God and men are laid bare, and let us there watch them throb and sob. It's a drama, all right. The stage of this drama is the heart of human beings. The principal character is you. You see, this is your life. There was a television program once entitled, "This Is Your Life." Well, this is your life tonight. There was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the portion of your substance that falls to me." And he divided to them his living. Not many days later, the younger son took all that he had and took his journey into a far country. And there he wasted his substance in riotous living. And when he had spent everything, a great famine arose in that country and he began to be in want. So he went and joined himself to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would gladly have fed on the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, How many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.' And he arose and came to his father. But while he was yet at a distance, his father saw him and had compassion, and ran and embraced him and kissed him much. And the son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fatted calf and kill it. And let us eat and make merry, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'" Now there are about five stations in this young man's life that I want you to see tonight. We'll deal with them briefly, but they're so important that we must not misunderstand them. I think, frankly, that of all the lessons that a person can sit and listen to, this lesson about the prodigal son or daughter is the most important that he could possibly hear. This is the gospel in one single nutshell, and you must understand it. The first station in this young boy's life was this. He came to his father and asked for that which was rightfully his. You see, the Oriental custom was that the fathers would lay up for the sons, and they would provide for them an inheritance. The younger son got a double portion, and all the other sons got a single portion. And so this young man came asking for that really which was rightfully his. His father had worked hard so that this young man could have what he was to give him. And we sometimes condemn this young man for coming and asking for that which was rightfully his, and we ought not to do that. You ought not to condemn this boy for coming to his father and asking for what belonged to him. It was that which his father had prepared for him, And his father would have been disappointed had this boy not obtained it and had not received it. He didn't ask for his brother's portion. He did not ask even for his own portion prematurely. It seems that this was in due course, and he had come to his father at the appointed time and said, "All right, give me that portion of your substance that falls to me." And had this young boy then taken that portion of his father's substance and gone down the road a ways, bought some ground, bought some cattle and some sheep, built him a house, married a lovely girl, raised some children, and why, his father would have been so pleased with him, it would have tickled him to death, because this was what his father gave him all of this substance for, was so that his son could get a better start in life, perhaps, than the father had had. So it was that he came to his father and received that which was rightfully his. Now I want you to do something. You must make the parallel application here to your own life. You see, without the parallel, there's no parable. This becomes just a story unless you get this one point where it becomes an application to your life. It becomes a parable. Otherwise, this is just simply a nice story of a boy who left home and wasted it and came back home. What's the parable in it? The parable in it is simply this. The parallel to this boy's life is your life and my life. When this boy came to his father and asked for what was rightfully his, it parallels your and my coming to our Father, God, and asking for that which is rightfully ours. For example, when you come to the age of maturity, as you grow up out of childhood and adolescence, and you come more into manhood, and all of a sudden you realize, you know, boy, and your voice drops, it begins to crack first, you boys, and then it drops, and then you begin to notice your muscles, you know, and you begin to look for some fuzz on your chin, and you don't find much, but then you begin to find a bit more, and you think, man, I believe I'm going to make it after all. I'm going to be all right. That happens around, what, 14, 16 maybe for a boy? Girls mature a lot younger than boys. They come around 6 or so, you know. 6 months, I mean. You get there a bit earlier. Not really, but you come on about 2 years earlier than we do, and you begin to fill out, and you begin to look more like a young lady. Your freckles, even if you retain them, become beauty spots, and you become someone really who is worth noticing, and the boys begin to notice. But what I'm saying is that each of us, as we come into this time of our life, into our maturing years, we begin, in a sense, to be aware of what it is that God has given us. And in a sense, we stand before him and we say, "Father, give me that portion of your substance that falls to me as one of your creation." And so he does. He divides us his whole substance. And watch what he gives us. He gives us a keen mind. He gives us tender emotions. He gives us understandings. He gives us a consciousness of right and wrong. He gives us aesthetic appreciation. He gives us moral awareness. He gives us all of these beautiful strains of Godship, really. He gives us all of these qualities of himself, perhaps in a lesser portion, obviously. But nevertheless, he places within each one of us, and as we hold out our hand and say, "Father, give me that part of your substance that falls to me." And he does it joyfully. He's so glad that he's made us like we are, and he wouldn't have changed us at all. And as you receive this inheritance from your father, your beautiful body, your lovely face, your kind countenance, your keen intellect, your sharp mind, your soft and tender compassion, your emotions, your drives, all of these things that he's given you, what would you pay for them? How much are they worth to you? How can you evaluate the worth of a brain and of a mind and a soul and emotions and tender passions and all these things? Aren't you rich? Oh, yes, you're rich. And each one of us stands before God at that particular coming out party of ours where we say, "Father, it's time. I want that that's been given to me. I want your portion of your substance that falls to me as your son or as your daughter." And you know, if we had taken those things and gone down the road a ways and built a house and married a wife and raised our family, and God would have been so pleased with us. But you know, we don't do that. We do the same thing this young man did. He didn't go down the road either, not to do what his father had intended for him to do. You know where he missed it? He selfishly misappropriated what God had given him to his own selfish ends. That's where he sinned. You know how we miss it? When we stand and God then gives us the portion of his substance that falls to us, we don't use it right either. We misappropriate it to our own selfish lusts and desires. And consequently, that's where our sin comes in. And we've all done it. Every last one of you here tonight has done it. You've misappropriated what God has given you. Oh, he's given you everything you need. My, what he hasn't given you. Give me the portion of your substance that falls to me. And yet, as this prodigal did, so do we. We selfishly misappropriate it to our own selfish lusts. And so he came, and so we come into this far country of sin. That's the second station in this young boy's life. He came first to his father and asked for what was rightfully his, and his father gave it to him very joyfully, freely. Secondly, he came into the far country of sin. It says here that not many days passed by. After he had come to his father and said, "Give me the portion that falls to me," it said his father did so. He divided to them his substance, his living. And then it says, and not many days later, he didn't just leave that very day. No, there were some days that he spent at home, but you know how he spent them? He was uncomfortable. He was chomping at the bit. He was impatient. He was tired of his father's restrictions. He was tired of the inhibitions and the curtailment of his freedom. He really was sick of all this. He'd lived with it for years. He didn't want any more of it. He wanted to be out there where the end people are. He wanted to be out there where the action is. And I can just see him pacing up and down in his room wondering, well, I wonder if I can go now without it being so obvious that I really want to get out of this place. And finally, he got up enough courage. He packed his bags, got his mule ready, and he went in and told his father, "Father, I'm going away for a while. I'll see you later." And his father looked at him and thought, well, all right. And so he got on his mule and he went down into this far country of sin. And there it says he wasted his substance in riotous living. Riotous living. I don't know whether that means much to you or not, but it meant a lot to this boy. That's what he was after, really. This boy wanted to be where he could do his own thing. He wanted what is being called today autonomous freedom, where he doesn't have to answer to anybody for anything. He wants to do what he wants to do. And that's where he went. And he went to the place where he felt like he could do it. He couldn't do it at his father's house. He didn't feel he had the freedom there. But he went into this far country. And there he wasted his substance in riotous living. I imagine he wanted to get it out of his system, don't you? You know what he means? I think he said, I want to get this out of my system. Not realizing that you don't get sin out of your system by sinning. Any more than you get drugs out of your system by taking drugs. That doesn't make sense, does it? No. But sin doesn't really make sense either. I suspect that he wanted to sow his wild oats. And I suspect that there was this urge in him. Man, I've been holding back. I want to get out there and get with it. I want to get these wild oats sowed. Well, all right, sow them. But you're going to have to reap them. You don't sow something without reaping it, young people. There was a young man that I used to, I grew up with him. And he was a great big, tall, fine-looking fellow, football player, and played center, played nose guard. And this young man dated and married one of the most beautiful girls in the school. And then later on, he began to run around on her. He began to live the life of an adulterer, and it was public. I went back home to where I was raised with him, and I saw him one day, and I got in the car with him, and I said, "Ralph, what's the matter with you? What's happened to you? What are you doing?" And he said, "Jim, you know, when we were growing up, the boys we ran around with, they all got it out of their system while they were young." He said, I never did get it out of my system. And I said, "Ralph, you're a fool. You don't get that sort of thing out of your system by sinning." But he didn't see it. And he ruined himself, broke his home, destroyed his home, broke his wife's heart, ruined his own life. This young boy was after that sort of thing. And I can just imagine the way he lived it up, the way he was so free with all of his substance, you know, the way he just wasted it in this riotous living. He wasted it in the sense that he was not very frugal at all. And I can imagine him saying, "The drinks are on the house, you know. It's all on me. Let me take care of it." And he spent all of his goods in this kind of living. But I want you to notice particularly here an expression. The expression is that he wasted his substance. I don't know of a more graphic description of sin than this, a wasting of your substance. Wasting of your substance. We've seen what this substance is. It's that which God has given us. It's that magnificent endowment with which God has given, with which He's made us the owners, or of which He's made us the owners. He's given us this great endowment from Himself. That's the substance. Sin then becomes the wasting of that substance, and it's the word that Jesus uses here. Sin is a wasting of your substance. Take, for example, a young boy, 18 years old. His muscles are toned. He's tanned. The set of his jaw has become one that's definitely masculine. His gait is one of manhood and strength. He has the opportunities and has the faculties to be responsible and creative and protective and all the other that goes along with being a man. You let that young man start drinking. Let him start taking drugs. Let him start ravaging his body with tobacco. Let him start prostituting himself with every whore in town. Let him start living a promiscuous life. Let him continue to do this over a period of 4 or 5 or 10 years, and then go back and then look at that young boy, and you're going to be shocked. I went back home this past year or 2 years ago and held a meeting out at a place in my hometown where another friend of mine lives. And I called him up especially and said, would you come to the meeting one night? And he did. He came. He wasn't but about 3 or 4 years older than I. But that man looked like he was my father, because that's the kind of life he had lived. What a wasting of your substance. You look at a young boy like that who becomes so engrossed in this kind of a life that he begins to be addicted to all these things, to where he's doing it more and enjoying it less, until finally he frantically reaches out for something that will give him satisfaction, but there isn't any. And he ends up as a drunkard, vomiting on himself, or lying in a gutter, drowning in his own vomit, that sort of a thing. And you look at that and say, my, what a wasting of your substance. Some years ago, I saw the picture of an 18-year-old girl in a newspaper. We were overseas at the time, and I think the picture, it either came out on the front page or on one of the news pages inside, but it was a large picture of this 18-year-old girl. The picture came from New York City. She had run away from home. She was one of the runaway generation. Her parents didn't know where she was. She had actually gone into the far country of sin, literally. The picture that was in the paper there was of this nude body, lying slumped in a filthy apartment with a knife in her back. She had been murdered. She had venereal disease. She was at that time pregnant. And there she lay in a slump, in a heap on the floor, dead, 18 years old. I thought, my, my, what a wasting of your substance. You see, within that little girl, or within that young woman, was a little girl once. And within that young woman, there lay those peculiar qualities that only a mother or a woman can possess. The tenderness of emotion, the warmth, the love, the gentleness, the touch of someone who is sincere and sacrificing. All of these, you see, were hers. That was the portion of her substance that God had given her as a woman. And she had this ability to reproduce. She had not only the ability to reproduce, but she had the ability and the capabilities of nursing and of nurturing and caring for a little tiny baby in an arm that only a mother's arm can care for, and feeding her from a breast that only a mother can feed her. All of this, you see, was her, this was her inheritance. But now she was dead, and I just nearly wept. I thought, oh my, 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 what a wasting of your substance. That's what sin is. That's what this boy did. And you can name them, not just these people. These don't have any names, really. They're people. I don't know their names. But you could name them in your own acquaintances. You perhaps can look at yourself and you can say, you know, that's where I am right now. I'm wasting my substance. I'm wasting my substance. Well, the next station that this young boy came to was the pig pen. He came to want and hunger. You know, sin always loses its power to satisfy. What once satisfied you doesn't satisfy you anymore. One shot that did you something before doesn't do that any longer. What made you high at one time takes 3 times that now to even affect you at all. What was one time good for you in the sense that that little bit affected you, it doesn't affect you anymore. One sin that one time affected you and made you feel good doesn't make you feel that way anymore. It takes more than that. You know, it's not because sin has changed that that's true. It's because sin changes you. That's why it takes more now. Sin always loses its power to satisfy because sin changes you. It takes those sensitive emotions and those gentle things that God has placed within you to respond to human relations and love and kindness and gentleness. All of these things that are your endowment from God. Sin takes those things and it twists them and warps them and causes them to be crusted over and hardened and burned and seared and insensitive. Because sin always loses its power to satisfy. The only harvest that sin ever produces is that of want. It's poverty, famine. The writer of Galatians says that those that sow to the flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. That's where this boy came. Until he finally came to the pig pen. You know, the wages of sin is death. The pleasures of sin are temporary. And then comes the pig pen. The pig pen here represents something perhaps even in your own life. It represents that degradation that brings you to a state even of doing things that are contrary to your nature. You thought, I would never do that. You can count on me. I'll never do that. And yet you stay in sin long enough and you'll find yourself right exactly where you said you would never be. This young boy was sent into the pig pens to feed the swine. I can imagine how it happened. He was throwing a party one night and he reached into his bag to pay for it and he couldn't find anything. And he reached further and there wasn't anything there. And he just looked up in embarrassment and said, sir, I don't know what's happened, but I'm out of money. And then the bartender said, throw this bum out. And they threw him out. And then all of his friends, they went on about their business with other people that they could take. But this boy was out in the gutter in the cold. And it says, and there arose a famine in that country and everybody began to be in want. He began to be in want. He might have gone to the first house and said, do you have anything that I can do in the way of a job? And they said, boy, we're in a famine time. There's no job available. Went on to the next house and knocked. Do you have anything that I can have in the way of work? I'll be glad to work. And then someone heard of this Jew and said, oh, yeah, you're a Jew, aren't you? He said, yes, sir. He said, yeah, Jew, I've got a job for you. You see those pigs down there in the field? I want you to go down there and feed them. Yeah, I'll pay you. I've got a job for you. And so in order to keep soul and body together, in order to get some last sustenance out of life, this young boy was forced to do that which was contrary to his very most inbred nature. He could not stomach the thoughts of being around a pig. And yet this was where he ended up. But that's not where the story ends. Thank God. The next station that he comes to is himself. He came to himself. This is a universal expression. If this parable had ended here, it would be one of great despair and despondency. It would be enough to cause a person to sit in gloom and look out his room and never utter a word because of such despondency settling over him. It would be where the world looks today. This is where the world is today. And they're sitting there in the pig pen, and that's as far as their story goes. But bless God for this one next statement. But when he came to himself. How beautiful that is. I think it's a universal expression. I think if you were to go over to China and say, do you know what mean come to self? They would say, ah, so, come to self. Yes, I know what that means. If you were to go to Germany and say, verstehen Sie, and then ask them, come to self, you understand what it means to come to yourself? They'd say, jawohl. Jawohl, I know. I know what that means. Everybody knows. You know what it means. You know it's universal because sin is universal. But coming to yourself as a cure of sin is because of the nature of sin. Sin is insanity of the soul. That's what sin is. Paul told the Corinthians, he said, come to your right mind and stop sinning. Why, sin is insanity of the soul. I'm not saying this to excuse you. I'm just simply saying that this is the nature of sin. It's not, you're not at yourself. You're not at your center of yourself. You're not really with it. But when he came to himself, he did something about it. I'm convinced that the finest hour in the life of a sinner is that moment when he comes to himself. It's priceless. You'll pay 1,000,000 worlds for it if you do not come to it now. when the time comes that you in the judgment come to yourself, you would give anything on God's earth if you had come to yourself here. That's how valuable it is. I remember once being in Nashville, Tennessee. I was the big age of 14, and I thought I knew enough to go up to Nashville, the big city, you know, and get around and do all right. I went on the bus, and I had some kinfolks there, but I didn't get in touch with my kinfolks. I was on my own. I wanted to be out, you know, but I got lost. Man, I tell you what, I never saw such big buildings. They grew about 50 feet the moment I got lost. And then I came to myself. I was crying, not on the outside. It's too big for that. I was on the inside, though, really was living it up. I couldn't stand it. I didn't think I'd ever get home. But then I came to myself, and on Church Street, it used to be the other way around, but that day, that whole thing just switched ends. Nobody saw it but me. Papers didn't catch it. Nobody caught it but me. But the whole thing, it just switched around. You know what caused it? I saw something that I recognized. And it was on the other side of the street from where I thought it was. And all of a sudden, here I went. And I came to myself. Do you know what it was that brought this boy to himself? Do you know what it was that caused the world to switch around? To where at one time he'd looked at his father's house as a place of oppression and the far country as a place of freedom? And now, all of a sudden, he sees his father's house as the place of freedom, and he sees the far country as that place of oppression. You know what it was that caused him to switch ends like that? The same thing. He saw something that was familiar. He smelled the bread of his father's table. In his mind's eye, it says, and he thought and said, how many of my father's servants have bread enough and to spare? And in that moment when he said that, his mind went back over the miles. And he thought of his father sitting there and his servants waiting upon him and that beautiful scene of contentment. And he came to himself. Oh, that's the finest hour in your life. Well, that did it. He got up. And I can imagine the memory as he had the memory. And then as the memory then produced this decision in him and this yearning. And then as he made the temporary or partial preparations, but all he could do. He didn't have any other clothes than what he had on, probably. He had no real money. He had no time for a bath. He had no mirror with him. The only mirror was probably a mud puddle there where he could look in and see part of his muddy, dirty face. And I can imagine him smoothing his face off and brushing off some of the crud and the grime and making his way. He got up and jumped that fence, that sty, and took off running. And the man said, well, wait, where are you going? He says, I'm going home. He said, but wait a minute, what about your job? He said, I don't want my job. Well, what about your pay? He said, mister, I've had about all the pay I can stand. I'm going home. And I don't imagine he sauntered home either. I bet you anything he ran as fast as he could until he couldn't run anymore and maybe sit down to rest a minute and take off running again. And so it was that he came to the last station in his life. He came back home to his father. He came back home again to his father. He had started out, you see, coming to his father and saying, give me the portion of your substance that falls to me. And then he came into the far country of sin and wasted it in riotous living and came to the point of hunger and famine and then came into the pig pen, as very low as he could get. And then he came to himself. And now he comes back home. When he first came to his father, he asked for what was rightfully his. The second time he came to his father, he asked for that to which he had no right whatsoever. He had already wasted what was rightfully his. But he came back to his father and said, Father, just make me one of your servants. Can you imagine that meeting? I can. The father saw him coming a long ways off. How do you think he recognized him? Ragged, dirty, scuffed up, dissipated. How did his father recognize him? There's not a father here tonight that doesn't know how his son walks. I don't even have to see my son's walking. I know which one it is by the way that the sound. I understand who it is by the sound they make, not just by looking at them at a distance. I know the way they walk, but I know the sound that they walk. I know how they walk. So did he. And he saw this boy coming, and I suspect that he had spent many a day working out in the field, his father had, looking down that road to see if he couldn't see a glimpse of his son. And when he saw him coming, I bet his heart jumped in him as he thought, there he comes, finally. And he took off running. Not in this direction. He took off running for him. And he ran and met him while he was a long ways off. He ran and met him and fell on his neck and kissed him much. That's what the word says. He kissed him much. Oh, he let him have it. He just hugged him and he kissed him, and I know they must have wept. The boy said, "Father, I'm so sorry. Forgive me. I've sinned against heaven and in your sight. Just make me one of your hired servants." Oh, no. No, his father wasn't going to let him be a servant. He deserved to be a servant. If there was any employment available, didn't he deserve to have a job? Yeah. But his father wouldn't allow that. His father wanted him back as a son. Oh, he said, "Quickly, bring the best robe and put a ring on his finger and shoes on his feet and take that fatted calf we've been fattening up. This is it. This is the occasion. Kill it and let's make merry. My son was dead and he's alive. He's lost and now he's found." And I can just imagine, and there was dancing and jigging and everything else. And the whole family was just one big party. What a joyful occasion that was. Yes, he wanted him home. There's a story that illustrates this. There was a boy who was such a heartache to his mother and father and such a threat to society that he was arrested by the police and put in prison. And he stayed there for years. Finally, though, during that stay in the prison, his heart was broken. He realized how sinful he had been. He came to himself in the prison. And he wrote a letter to his father and he said, "Father, I'm so sorry for the way I've lived and disgraced you and my mother." He said, "I'm coming home. I'm being released next week." Or the next week, or whenever it was. He said, "I'll be home on such and such a day." He said, "Now, I want to come home. I don't know whether you want me home or not. But I'm going to be coming on the train past the house on such and such a day at such an hour." He says, "If you want me home, would you please just put a rag out in the peach tree in the orchard? When I see it, I'll know that you want me home." Well, the story says that the father was there at the house and the boy was on the train. He got on the train and came on toward the home. He was afraid to look. But he came on close and he stole a glance out the window and he didn't see the rag in the tree. His father had instead put every bed sheet in the house on that tree. Every one of them was out there like some May Day celebration. He didn't want him to miss the message. Oh, he could have put a rag there. But the boy might have missed the rag, you see, and gone on by and not ever got the message that "I want you home." But when he put every bed sheet in the house on that tree, there wasn't any way he could miss the message. Now listen to me. That's what God did for you and me when he put Jesus in the tree. He didn't want us to miss that message. He could have put Moses there. He could have hung John the Baptist or Elijah or any one of a host of other people. He could have put him in the tree and crucified him. But he didn't do it. When he put his son, he was saying to me, "I don't want you to miss the message." Thank God he put him there. Thank God when I was in prison and I came home and I wanted to know, "Do you really want me home?" He had every bed sheet in the house on that tree saying, "Come home. I want you back. I want you home." Golgotha is that place in history where God runs to meet every prodigal and falls on his neck and kisses him much. There it is. It's in the cross of the Lord. And there he hangs. Do you get the message? Do you get the message tonight? There he hangs. And it's God simply saying to you, "I want you home." People, there's never been an event in history of all of God's dealings, of all the history of humanity, there has never been an event like this one that took place some 2,000 years ago where God hung this man in a tree so that you and I might not miss the message. He wants us home. Now, where are you tonight? You're at one of these locations. You're at one of these stations. If you're accountable, you're either at your father's house, chomping at the bits, wanting to get away, and you'll get away. There's not a team of horses that could hold you. More than likely, though, most of you are, you've already left, and you're in the process of wasting your substance right now, selfishly misappropriating it. Or you may be in the pig pen. You may have already wasted it, and you're there at the very bottom of the gutter. Or it may be, by the grace of God, that you've come to yourself. You may have come to yourself right now, tonight. This may be the very evening when you've come to yourself and you need to come home. You know what's going to happen? When God sees you coming home, you know where he's going to meet you? He's going to run to meet you. And somebody said, "Listen, you can hear the looms of heaven weaving the cloth for a new garment for a prodigal. Listen to it." That's what's happening. God is running to meet you if you just come. If you've gotten the message tonight, and that message is simply, "Come, I want you back home." And the boy and the girl, the man and the woman, who will come to the cross of Jesus Christ and will allow himself to die to sin turning your back on the pig pen and the pleasures of whatever preceded it, and then unite yourself in that death, be buried like he was buried, be raised to walk this new life. He'll put a new garment on you, put a ring on your finger, shoes on your feet. He'll kill the fatted calf. There'll be this great triumphant feast of joy because you were lost and now you're found. This is your life. Where are you? This is the gospel. Will you respond to it while we stand and sing?